Welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on the program today. My guest is West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. We'd love to have your questions on the show for him today. You can call those in to area code 765-496-1999. You can also tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter, and you can email your questions to ask@wbaa.org. Mr. Mayor, good afternoon.
Where you been?
I have been busy for the last first Thursday of the month for several months now. We were looking at this. I think it's been maybe since May that you and I have spoken on this
show.
I
know. You kind of look like Nixon. You know, you look like Nixon after his San Clemente retreats. You're all tanned, rested, and ready.
I thought you were going to say I looked like Nixon during the 1960 debates where I looked like I was really sickly
and
nobody would ever want to elect me.
You just look nice and relaxed, you know?
Uh-huh.
So let's see if I can mess that up for you for a while.
All right. Well, I'll give you the chance to respond to some listener questions first. We actually had a trio of them on the same topic that came in this week within about an hour and a half of one another.
Really?
And so they are as follows. Marcia writes, what is happening with Morton? And then Sue says, what is the status of the Morton / City Hall renovations? It all seems rather quiet on Chauncey Avenue. And then Liz wants to know, what is happening with the Morton Center renovation? Nothing seems to be happening. Is there a timeline as to when it would begin and be finished? So to Marcia, Sue, and Liz, you say?
Marcia. Do you know what that's a reference to?
Yes, but I don't know if they are Brady Bunch watching age or not.
Does that make us horrible? Yes, the project is in progress. We are just about ready to get the demolition permits taken care of. A lot of those things, when you look at what we're doing, it's a building that's almost 100 years old. It was finished as a school in the late 1920s. And there's a lot of stuff in there that isn't really the best to get aerated, like asbestos. So prior to us being able to do anything from the visible side of the house, there's a lot of things that we need to do internally. You got to get all the asbestos out. You got to bag it and tag it and get it disposed of properly. You got to check all the available spaces to make sure that there's nothing of that type hiding in there. You also have to go and do what they call an overall structural assessment, which means they got to go in there and make sure that the building itself is strong enough to be able to handle the demolition that's going to go on within. Because if you remember, and I think we've talked about this some time ago, but the building is basically going to be the same on the outside, but the inside's going to be gutted and it's going to be a brand new building on the inside. The other thing is that the contractors that do these things, we had originally signed an agreement with one contractor who fell slightly short of the mark. So we fired them and brought in a new one. And so they had to go through the process of basically getting their team on board, getting everything squared away, and that probably put us behind about a month or two. But generally speaking, when you do a remodel as opposed to a scrape and rebuild, there's a lot more things that go on inside of the building that people don't see. So it really kind of sort of does look like nothing's going on, but a lot of work is going on inside the structure of that building.
So there are people in there right now doing things?
Off and on, yeah. There's a lot of auditing going on, a lot of assessments going on, a lot of testing going on.
Okay. We also have a question from Diane, which we were not able to get to last month, and she writes, would stronger or different building codes have prevented the spread of the fire that destroyed 5 homes in Lindberg Village? Have building codes been included in the investigation of contributing factors? And we'll point out, I guess, at this point that the official designation of that fire's cause was undetermined.
Yeah.
And so what are your responses to her about changing the building codes and with the acknowledgement that this is largely a county thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm going to put on one of my old hats before that I used to wear. I used to wear an old police hat. Well, actually, it was an old one I wore. It was brand new when I wore it. But once again, I ramble. There are things that government can do, things that government can't do, and things that government should do. And we live in a weird dynamic now where we're talking about, local economies. We're talking about ways that government can generate revenue. We're talking about, you know, the burden of taxes on our citizenry and trying to relieve that burden. And that creates a lot of different both good and bad opportunities for government, for developers, and obviously for the people that are purchasing those products. The process of building a house is fairly simple. You knock on the door of some bureaucrat, say, I want to build this house. They look at it, say, okay, that's fine, and off you go to build it. Basically the same sort of scenario applies for developers. They go to a governmental entity and say, knock, knock, we want to build this development. They go through a checklist and say, okay, and off they go and build. We actually saw each other out there at the fire scene shortly after it was over, and you and I were both shaking our heads thinking, wow. Because personally, I've seen a lot of weird stuff, but I've never seen such a hot fire and evidence of the heat of that fire so far away from the actual original source. It was kind of disturbing.
And for people who don't remember, there were houses that were literally across the street.
Yeah.
There were five houses on one side of the street that were essentially demolished, but houses across the street that had their siding melted off from all of the heat that were dozens and dozens of feet away.
Yeah, and the siding was dripping.
Right.
I mean, it looked like a bad sci-fi film. But the way the rules read is there is a certain requirement of footage between a house. And it can be as small as 6 feet, and then it could probably be indefinite for how far away it can be. And again, I'm speaking basically from conversations that I've had, but not from something that I've recently read. With that understanding, when a situation like that happens, it's pretty simple to see that when fire gets hot, it's going to spread. And the proximity between one house to the next house, it's going to be encouraging for that. Also, the materials come into play. Everything that has to be built has to pass fire code. The products that they use has to pass fire code. And if it doesn't, then should something like that happen, then somebody's going to have to be held accountable. But long way to the short way is, yes, you know, as a mayor of a city that's one of the most densely populated cities, not just in the state, but in the country because of our university being within the city limits, it wakes me up at night when I think about that horrible what if. What if we had a very significant fire event in one of our densely populated neighborhoods? Are we allowing enough space in between houses? Because we still have enough older housing stock in our city, the spaces, the yards are all pretty significant. There's a lot of green space from house to house. However, there are trees. However, there is heat that we experience. The other thing is the materials that the older houses were made of. You know, they were made to last. That's why they're still here after 100 plus years. But it is a concern. So when we now have conversations with developers, there's things that we as city government can do. And there's things that the county government and in some cases even state government can do. Probably one of the biggest things is that when a development is permitted to build houses within 12 feet of each other, which, as we saw because of the heat going across the street, isn't going to help if you have a significant fire event. So
right after that fire, I talked with Ed Ward, the Wabash Township Fire Chief, and he was talking to me about this and saying that he thought a big problem were zoning rules that were perhaps a little bit too lax about houses being built close together.
Mm-hmm.
So to Diane's point, are you as a city thinking about going to the various county entities and saying, hey, we just had this experience. We would like to advocate on behalf of changing these rules on making sure that anytime a development is built in the county from now till time immemorial, that the houses are farther apart.
We've had those conversations preliminarily just to figure out what is it that needs to be done. I mean, is it a state sanctioned thing? Is it a county sanctioned thing? Where does fire code fall into this? You know, fire inspectors prior to development usually have to sign off, and it's usually not necessarily based on their experience. It's based on the law. And we deal with this in all kinds of different ways. It's sometimes it's not only for fire safety. Sometimes it's for vehicular safety, for road safety. You know, one of the hardest things to do is to get a stoplight. You know, we get a lot of calls from people saying, "Hey, John, this is a busy intersection. Could you put a stoplight here today?" And we tell them, you know, first off, if it's a state highway intersection, that's a big deal because then we have to go through the state and that becomes, you know, bureaucratic hell. Even if it's local, we have to do what they call a warrant, which means we have to count the volume of traffic. We have to count during different times of day. We have to, if it's a school, sort of
prove that you need it, basically.
Ding dong. Exactly. And that proof has to be submitted to a governing body that says, okay, you know, thou shalt. And that's, You know, that's when government can kind of be its own worst enemy.
And so, obviously, if you change the rules, if the county decides to change the rules, there is the economic other side of
sure.
it, which is if a developer comes in and says, we'd like to build a new development like Lindbergh Village, mm-hmm. and you look at a similar sized footprint, you're just physically not going to be able to put in as many mm-hmm. homes. That developer may not be able to thus sell as many properties mm-hmm. or make as much money on the same footprint mm-hmm. going forward. Do you think that the lobby of developers and the ability that they have to kind of say, well, look, we can withhold this money and thus this property tax revenue from you, mm-hmm. the city, and you, the county, has a factor in this discussion of whether these laws get changed?
Yeah, well, they are a very powerful group at the state level. And if we are in any time, at least here locally, if we're in a position to create a safer environment, we're always going to advocate that. Some of this isn't just, you know, the greed factor. It's also the house style du jour. My parents built a house 60 years ago in Barbary Heights. And back in those days, everybody wanted a big yard. I mean, you wanted to have a big fenced-in yard so you can have a dog and so my dad could keep me from running around and getting lost in the neighborhood and all that. Well, that's changed. People want what they call postage stamp size yards now, smaller yards. And so if that product is what's in demand, developers are going to go ahead and accommodate that need. The other thing is the materials that the houses are being made of and some of the safety codes that are essential to have within the houses. I'm not familiar with what the source of the fire was. I can't remember what it was that started it. But
well, that's actually one question I wanted to ask you was, mm-hmm. what do you make of the fact that this fire was ruled undetermined? I mean, we waited, I think it was 5 or 6 weeks after the fire until that was announced. I talked with people from the state fire marshal's office who were on scene. I talked with Chief Ward, who had been on scene for several days. Mm-hmm. And everybody said, hey, we're having all these investigators come out and look into it, and all of these insurance adjusters come out and look into it. And so you've got literally dozens of people who surveyed this scene.
Experts.
And they're all like, I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
I don't know. I mean, I used to do crime scene investigations. We used to investigate homicides and burglaries and arsons and all kinds of stuff. And we could narrow it down to a certain type of thing, whether it was human, mechanical, or other. And I am talking way out of my league here. And any firefighters out there, I apologize. But I would presume that there are certain categorizations that can be, it can be narrowed down to. The other thing is that insurance companies and builders and all these different groups probably have a better understanding of how these things start in the first place. You know, professional fire investigators, if they can find a heat source, they know that might be it. If they can find a burn pattern, they might know that at least might be where it is, and they can start doing a little bit more forensic investigations there. But truth be told, it, you know, sometimes it just is, I don't know, because if the fire gets hot enough, everything's out. Everything goes away.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. Call in your questions at 765-496-1999. Email ask@wbaa.org or tweet those questions at WBAA News on Twitter. We did a story earlier this week about the West Lafayette downtown plan, which the Area Plan Commission had taken public comment on, and they mm-hmm. presented some of that public comment this mm-hmm. week. Another listener wanted to know what evaluation rubrics or metrics or tools were used by the steering committee to determine how each comment would be incorporated into the plan.
The good thing about having a small base group is that a lot of it can just be done with simple. I mean, you just simply do it. You just take the group, you do some real basic analysis, and you put them into particular categories and send it out that way. This isn't the first time we've kind of done these things. I mean, we do these sort of sensing sessions all the time. And you would be amazed at how many responses are reflections of each other. You know, we get a room full of 50 people. You probably would have less than 10 unique responses because you know how we are.
I have been to meetings like
this. Yeah, you've seen them. And mm-hmm. and even more so, Stan, because we've both done this for a long time, we can almost predict what those are going to be, you know?
Right. There are definitely, there are typically cadres of people who want to talk about issue X or issue Y.
Yeah. But when we're talking about the downtown plan, it has several different sectors that are going to be implemented or impacted. You've got a business community, you've got a residential community, you've got college students, you've got long-time residents, you've got temporary residents, as such as in people who want to stay in a hotel room. And then, of course, all the different amenities that go around that. And where we are right now is still trying to sort some of that out. The opinions are very strong. You know, we know what people want, not just in West Lafayette, but in Greater Lafayette. You know, they want bikes, they want the bike paths, they want trails, they want outdoor recreation opportunities, they want franchise restaurants, they want mom and pop restaurants, and they want affordable housing. And all of that is getting discussed within this plan. The other thing is that because of what we're doing, and this is kind of cool, you know, we are building a downtown kind of all at the same time. And usually downtowns are part of a multi-century evolutionary process, but this is going to take place in just a matter of a few years. So the hope is that whatever suggestions we get now will be coupled with the historic perspective of what we're doing. So we won't necessarily, you know, put a splash pool in the middle of a park, and then all of a sudden splash pools become like, you know, dens of inequities or breeding grounds for germs and all. So the input's important. You know, we do with it what we can. We compare it to universal data to see, you know, if there's any trends that are going on a bigger scale nationwide or maybe even globally, and then try and bring that home to something that's going to fit in Greater Lafayette.
Wanted to ask you about a couple things that are on the agenda for this month's city council meeting, which takes place on Monday. First, you're sponsoring an ordinance that talks about conflicts of interest in the issuance of building permits. Yeah. What prompted that discussion?
Nothing really prompted it. It's just good business. You know, there is always that question if, you know, the police the police. You know, how can you be fair? How can you maintain objectivity? So this is just something that would basically prevent, you know, building commissioners and house inspectors from inspecting their own stuff. The other thing is that when you look at government overall, we've always seemed to be kind of swimming in and out of the slime. There always seems to be some governmental entity that's doing something just egregious and wrong. And so we want to try and make sure that when you look at the development that we have going on, when you look at the number of people that are being impacted, you're looking at how we're doing business, both internally and externally with all the people that are coming into town. We just want to make sure that we're doing everything above board, and you kind of take, you untick that one box to where they won't be able to say, well, aha, you know, he either is an investor here or he or she has an apartment here or whatever the case may be.
How do you police all of those potential conflicts of interest?
Well, you really have to hope that, you know, once you get out of the black and white portion of it, that there's people with or that are of high integrity that work for you. You know, in years past, there used to be different jobs in government that were fairly lucrative, and it wasn't necessarily because of the paycheck you were getting. You know, inspectors, people that dealt with, we call it quality of life issues now, but back in the old days, people that could, you know, write you a ticket for, you know, growing your grass too high or you know, basically.
Or issue licenses for certain things.
Yes, licenses, permits, that kind of stuff. And with the transparency of government now, those things are just, they just go away. But, you know, every now and again, you're going to get a rotten egg. And because of the general suspicions that people have of government, there's always somebody that's going to say, hey, wait a second. You know, this guy went into that apartment. It's trashed. And he walked out. You know, I don't know what he was sticking in his pocket, but it looked like an envelope. So we want to see what's going on with that. And we immediately inspect. Now, having said all that, I have never seen that happen here.
Well, so I have to ask, because I've spent enough time covering the State House to have watched this happen a couple of different ways, to notice that a lot of times you will get legislation that is written because one lawmaker has seen one instance of one thing that they want to curb, and suddenly you get a proposal for a state law. Mm-hmm. But in many cases, it's well-minded. It's we want to stop this thing from happening again. You're telling me you're not aware of any sort of people who have the issuance of permits in their purview issuing themselves permits?
Not state, not local government permits, no.
Okay.
Then again, if I say that, you could probably make a phone call and somebody go, oh, huh, you know, but as far as I know, no. And here's the other thing. You know, we talk about the potential for corruption across the board, whether it be a mayor, whether it be a cop, whether it be a fireman, whether it be an inspector, whether it be a laborer. That stuff is criminal. And you would be surprised at how many people really do realize that this isn't worth going to jail for. And that's kind of a good, even if that was just one of those single source legislations that took place, that's kind of a good thing to have on the books for a motivator.
I want to ask you about another agenda item that's moving some money around, about $360,000 in the city's general fund. And I think I may have found, according to our conversation before the show, a typo on the city's website. The listed budget classification on the page, and we pulled it up before the show, says personal, but you are telling me that it should say personnel instead.
Yeah,
those would be a little different.
Yeah, they are. But it's funny because it's a category that is used by the state, and it is personnel. I thought it would be personal. I thought it would be personnel, but the state uses that category for both.
Okay, and so what is that? What is that $360,000 for?
What's personnel?
Which personnel specifically?
Yeah, what it is, it goes into a fund that it covers costs for personnel, salaries, different things like that. So it's just your basic human costs for having folks on. And, you know, the oddity is that when we do, this is one of those things that I found always just really interesting about local government. You know, we go through a process and we approve a budget every year. And then every month, we always, and I've done this on both sides of the river, we always sort of just manipulate funding around in the budgets. And the reason for that is that a lot of times, you know, local government operates a lot like everything else. We've got seasons where we know things are going to get really expensive, and we have seasons where we know things are going to be a little bit more fiscally forgiving. And that's why a lot of times you'll see the money shuffling around. And the every now and again, specifically when we get new legislators on our council, they ask that question. It's like, what are you doing? Why didn't you just ask for this amount of money in the first place? And the simple answer to that is that, well, we can't predict the weather. You know, we never know how cold it's going to get. We never know how much salt we're going to need. We never know how much overtime it's going to require to do all these things. So the state has empowered us to move money from within a budget without legislation and then from fund to fund by going through our city council to do so. And because of the size of West Lafayette and because of the size of our budget, we do it quite frequently. And a lot of it has to do with the amount, because the amounts of money that we're talking about are so small that you probably in some cases can make an error just predicated on the weather because you don't need that much salt. And then we can put that to some other place where it can be more appropriately applied.
There's also this resolution that's going to be talked about, which we did a story on the other day, sets some pretty ambitious targets for the city to reduce its carbon footprint. 20% at a time in an ongoing fashion, 20% this 4 years, 20% after another 4 years. Mm-hmm. So a number of questions about that. First of all, let's talk about the very first one of these rounds. Mm-hmm. You want to spend the next 4 years reducing by 20% your impact on climate change and the environment. That seems like it might be a pretty costly endeavor.
Ah.
Is it?
Not so much. We have, you know, the city of West Lafayette is different than a lot of cities. We don't have industry. We don't have smokestacks. We don't have the challenges.
Wouldn't that make it even harder for you to have that amount of impact?
No. Because one of the biggest, actually within the geographic footprint of the city, you know one of the biggest polluters that we actually have? What it is? 5 seconds?
Four. Purdue University.
No, you have to form it in the answer of a question.
What is Purdue University?
See, man, you're used to that stuff, aren't you?
Yeah.
No, actually, for us, Purdue University, they've got their utility plant, which, yes, it is. For us, it is our wastewater treatment utility.
Okay.
And because of how that's done, because of how the biosolids are processed, because of the technology that they used, the antiquated technology, it's spewing things off at a higher level than anywhere else. Because again, we're talking rooftops and treetops and that sort of stuff. So Dave Henderson, he's kind of like our climate change guru. He gets it. And so he is going through a process of lowering that by just capturing the fumes and recycling them through a digester process. The other thing is we've got ample space out there to put in some solar panels, which we're going to do.
Don't both of those things have a cost associated with them?
They do. One upfront cost, but then the return is much greater, and it lowers that CO2 thing.
This is kind of what I'm asking is, it seems one of the reasons that things like solar panels, wind turbines, et cetera, have not been adopted is because people are concerned about the cost, and in some cases concerned about government subsidy of these things, where there are folks who say, should we even be doing this if the government has to help offset the cost of this for it to become cost efficient? So this sounds like the digester, the solar panels, these are going to cost you up front, are they not?
They will cost up front. But again, what's your objective? You know, we're trying to do the right thing for our planet. We're trying to lessen our carbon footprint. You know, roundabouts, those are another, excuse me, those are another incredible device that people don't really recognize until they get explained to about it. You know,
and your argument there is you're not idling the car, so you're not spending as much gas.
You heard my other interview, didn't you?
It was on our station. I heard it.
You can't kibitz me.
I've got other questions I want to get to here.
Okay, this is
a resolution. It does not have the force of law.
Right.
So you've got ambitious targets mm-hmm. for the first 4 years, which become arguably exponentially more ambitious for the next 20%.
Oh, as you wind that down, yeah, because what's the eventual outcome? Zero?
So,
over a period of time,
so
yeah.
So how do you get people to do something that is going to become harder and harder over time mm-hmm. and not just have it be, this is our idealized goal of what we'd like to do, but force people into making what yeah. are going to be some tough changes and maybe some expensive expenditures?
Well, a couple things. First off, this is a start. This is where we, this is sort of ground zero. This is where we're beginning this whole concept and process. That when we had the rally last Friday with the students from the high school and others, it was made abundantly clear that there is a large group of people who feel very passionate about what we're doing to our planet. Those are the folks that we're handing the baton off to. We will start, you know, us guys, you know, boomer. Are you a boomer?
I'm not.
What are you?
A child of a boomer.
Oh, God.
Child of two boomers.
Right through the heart, right there. Yeah, Stan, just made me feel old.
Sorry.
But anyway, you know, our generation, my generation, is still, you know, thinking along the lines of pitch in. We, you know, we're still emotionally affected by the tear running down the American Indian's cheek.
The old television ad.
There you
sure.
go. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And so we pat ourselves on the back if, you know, our recycling toter is filled more than our garbage can is. But that's that. That's where we are today. The next generation realizes that, you know, what we are doing with things that you can't see, you know, the stuff that's coming off the stuff that's doing this horrible thing to our environment is equally as important and has to have as equally as much attention put to it and are willing to make those necessary sacrifices. I've got a friend of our daughter's and Michelle's, I'm not going to say her age, but she's old enough to vote plus 10 plus 4. But you know, her friends are considering getting rid of their cars. You know, they're looking about, you know, alternative modes of transportation like scooters and hoverboards. So, you know, society's starting to change. You know, my generation, you know, we're the ones that the fingers need to be pointed at because we're the one that messed this up. You know, your generation is the one that's aware. Your kids' generation are going to be the ones that are going to make this change, and they'll be willing to make that sacrifice.
All right, Mr. Mayor, as always, we've run out of time before we run out of questions, but thanks as always for your time, and we'll do it again next month.
Okay, I'm sorry if I sounded awkward today. We're in a new studio, and I feel kind of lost. You know, I don't have any pins to play with. I can't click my pin like I used to drive Stan crazy.
We will get used to all of the change,
yes, we
environmental,
will.
Studio, and otherwise. This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember to visit our website, WBAA.org, where you can find archived versions of this program. You can always send your emailed questions to ask@WBAA.org, and you can follow us on Twitter @WBAA News. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.